Today's program is brought to you by Tabard Inn, new American cuisine in one of Washington, D.C.'s oldest hotels, located in DuPont Circle. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
I'm Erica Wise, host of Let's Get Real, the cooking show about finding, preparing, and eating food. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Food and memories. Food memories. We're going to talk about all of that today on A Taste of the Past. Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palaccio, on this journey through culinary history, or on this journey through the history of our lives. It's all about food, either way you look at it. And indeed, food and smells are two of the tastes and smells are two things that can set off very intricate memories. And my guest today is an author who writes with that evocative sense of food and smell and her life and memories of her family. It is indeed a memoir about family, but it's a memoir about food. And I'm talking about Elissa Altman and her new book, Trafe, My Life as an Unorthodox Outlaw. Elissa is the author of the critically acclaimed memoir, Poor Man's Feast. Excellent, and I love the blog Poor Man's Feast, and she also has another column, Feeding My Mother. Is it Feeding My Mother? Or I have to feed my
feeding. I do have to feed my mother, but yeah. Feeding My Mother.
Feeding My Mother.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
And that's the column you write in the Washington Post. Correct?
I wrote it for a year,
Now it's just a
exactly.
So it morphed into your own to another blog.
Yes.
I see. Okay. And her work has appeared in lots of magazines, including the New York Times and Oprah Magazine, and her work has been anthologized for 5 consecutive years in Best Food Writing. She lives in Connecticut with her family, and you're also a cookbook editor. You were for a long time. Are you still editing?
Very infrequently.
Okay.
I'm writing full-time now.
Who has time to edit someone
else's
work? Right. And, of course, you've been a personal chef and a caterer and all those food things that people do, wear so many hats when they're in the food world.
We right? all do them.
Right. And the Poor Man's Feast blog won a James Beard award, and congratulations. I do so enjoy that.
Thank you so much.
It is very much like I have to say that I sort of just traveled from your blog right into the book, and your voice is there. It's the same. Your voice is very strong. And this book, Trafe, is indeed a memoir about family, but these memories are all inspired by food. Pretty much.
They are all inspired by food. And you know, I grew up in a place where my mother and father had oppositional relationships with food and the table. And I got very different messages from them. The one message that I got from them was that food could be forbidden. And, of course, that's what Trafe refers to. That's what the title refers to. But I grew up in the 1960s and 70s at a time where there was a lot of the forbidden going on all around.
Yeah, so Trafe becomes this trope for your outlaw status, as you put it.
That's exactly right, in every way, shape, and form.
Right, so, right. Yeah. It's interesting because the book, I mean, people will just have to pick up the book and read it for themselves because it's one of these things that you can, it's a straight read through. You can't put it down. You just have to go right from beginning to end.
Thank you.
And it's, as one reviewer said, the Trafe, the unkosher and the prohibited, as you said, but then also, according to your grandmother, a great figure in the book, it also, as we said before, it stands for imperfect, intolerable, broken, offensive, filthy, forbidden, illicit, you know, rule-breaking. And that really then comes from food and a meaning of food. Let me ask you, in food, and you've been editing for so many years, and now you're writing full-time, to be a good food writer, your food writing is not like, you're not going to pick up, it's not the same as picking up a magazine and leafing through and reading an article about someone's trip to Paris and what they ate. But it is food writing on a different level. It's food writing as literature. And
thank you.
What do you feel about writing, to be a good writer, to be a good food writer? What are some of the things that are important to you?
Well, I think that memory is, for me anyway, is certainly visual and olfactory, but it's taste as well. And so as a writer, I immediately, when I think about my past growing up in the 1960s and 70s, and New York was a very, very different kind of food place than it is now, and with very definite flavors and scents and tastes, and those are the things that spur my memory. And so when I sit down to write, and I'm writing about, you know, walking down 3rd Avenue and 81st Street in the 1970s with my parents or with my dad, there were a lot of German restaurants in that area. There mm-hmm. was a very famous bakery called Mrs. Herbst Bakery, which is long defunct. I think actually Nora Ephron wrote a brilliant article about cabbage strudel. I mean, who eats cabbage strudel, right? And Mrs. Herbst was like the only place in New York City where you could get that. And I remember that smell, and that's what spurs the memory for me. That's what compels me to sit down and to try and recreate that, the smell and the taste and the flavor and what was going on. And then that, that sort of results in memories of what people were wearing and what people right. looked like and music that I was hearing at that time. And it's a sort of, multi, sense experience right. for me.
Right. We all have triggers. Well, of course, triggers become this bad buzzword, but we all have things that trigger our memory. And indeed, food for people who I think are, we were talking before the show, people who are foodies, if you will. I hate that word, but you know, sometimes it's very descriptive.
Right. We know who we are.
Right. Very involved with food. You know, food is often what it is. A lot of people, as you mentioned, they'll remember exactly what they wore in 1975 to so-and-so's, you know, party.
Right.
I will always remember what was served. I'll always remember what I ate. I don't know what I wore, but yeah. I know what I ate. Yeah. And so food is always, you know, they're up front in my mind.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that if you ask a lot of food writers, I'm loathe to say foodies, but
yeah.
foodies,
yes.
you know, that's
food
what we're
writer.
Talking about.
Food writers.
Food writers. And even people who are not food writers, but that's their way into memory. I think that there are a lot of really brilliant writers out there who are not necessarily food writers. We wouldn't call them food writers, mm-hmm. but they can write brilliantly and evocatively.
Well, look at Calvin Trillin.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, Mary Carr is certainly another
right.
person who, and I said to her not you know long ago, maybe a couple of years ago. So when are you going to write your food memoir? And she just sort of cringed, digitally cringed. I could sort of hear it. You know.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and Ruth Reichel went from you know the food, literally food world of cooking and then editing, of course, Gourmet Magazine, to writing memoirs too, and effectively. And I think that it is such a sensory, food is such a sensory item product, that it is, encompasses so much more,
right,
you
right.
know, that has to be written about. Certainly in your book, and I said we weren't going to go too much in the book, but of course I have to.
Of course you have to, yeah.
There, you talk a lot about, of course, the importance of Chinese restaurants in your life. Expand upon that a little bit. I mean, did you feel like an outlaw every time you walked into a Chinese restaurant?
I it's a funny thing.
There are kosher Chinese restaurants.
There are, but there weren't back then.
Right.
And
right.
and my dad, my beloved dad, who I lost in 2002, always used to say that you could tell a Jewish neighborhood by the number of Chinese restaurants in it, and he could never explain that to me. And I have a lot of Chinese American friends who I have asked, so what's this connection? And that, and I think part of it is being an outsider early on in the 20th century and being a part of a very specific community. And certainly at Christmas time, if you were Jewish and you were looking for a restaurant to eat in during Christmas time, they were all closed,
right?
Except for the Chinese restaurants.
Right.
So there's that. I also think that there's definitely a culinary connection between kreplach and dumplings.
Sure.
I mean, that makes sense, right? And but for me, growing up in Forest Hills in the 60s and 70s, there was a Chinese restaurant that was literally at the center. It was sort of like the aorta, like the center of town. Queens Boulevard came out of it in one direction, and Yellowstone Boulevard came out of it in another direction. And the place was called the Tung Shing House, and it was a couple of blocks from our synagogue, and everybody went there. Sunday nights, every Jewish family in Forest Hills was lined up waiting.
I think you could say predominantly in New York. Right?
In New York, right. Was lined up, you know, waiting to get in. And as I relate the story early on in the book, in the opening scene where, you know, I go to a bat mitzvah of a friend of mine who was fairly religious, far more religious than I was growing up, and we all went out for our luncheon at the Tung Shing House afterwards, and of course what was being served was shrimp and lobster sauce. And I didn't really think anything about that, but I suddenly was very inquisitive about what the pink-tipped meat floating in the wonton soup was, and my father said, shut up, just, you know, eat it. And I, you know, I thought it was chicken, but it, of course, wasn't. And so, you know, there was a little bit of there was the forbidden there, and whenever we went there, that's, you know, we used to, my father used to also like to say that that pork is not kosher unless it's in an egg roll. So, and I think a lot of Jewish listeners will, you know, will relate to that.
I think you're probably absolutely right. Well, and when did the food taste better because it was forbidden?
Well, I didn't really know that it was forbidden for a long time. It just sort of was until I had that sort of that moment of saying, "Hey, Dad, you know what's this pink tipped
right.
meat?"
Yeah.
Then he kind of cringed and bristled. It was salt. It hit every every taste, every sensor. So it was salty and sweet and crunchy and fried and all of those things that we all love so much. And to this day, my comfort food is, I love chicken soup and I love, I love traditional comfort foods, but my go-to comfort food, if I'm under the weather, is Chinese food.
Hmm. That's interesting.
And where I live in northern Fairfield County in Connecticut, there's not a whole lot of it up there, but that's my go-to always.
And it's just not the same when you cook it yourself, even though you can make really fine, sweet and sour soup.
Yeah,
it's just not the same.
It's not. And I think it's a heat thing. I do think it's a heat thing. Hmm. Most of us just can't get our woks that hot,
right.
And we just don't. I would like to say that I have a feel for cooking Chinese food, and I make it a lot, but it's not the same as the Tung Shing House.
Hmm.
Of course, there's the MSG issue also.
That's right. But you did describe a very, very sensual, in a way, seeing parts of it when you bought and ordered a half a pig, and then didn't go into all the recipes and cooking, but a few, and the whole. And of course, the poor man's feast has the symbol of the pig,
on the
front of it. That so you just, I mean, everything has been, you know, cast to the winds, and you now buy a side of pork. And
well, I mean, I love pork. And to be clear, I didn't grow up in a kosher household, and My father was born here. His father was born, as they say, in the old country, and came here at 11 years old by himself in 1905. And settled in New York, and you know, wound up working for the Daily Forward, the Jewish Daily Forward, and a couple of other newspapers, and was very involved in Yiddish theater. And in his home, my grandfather's home, they kept kosher, but my father considered himself American through and through. And when he went off to the Navy to be a night fighter pilot. And he was a 19-year-old officer away from home for the first time. His officer's club fed him an all-pork dinner, and he never went back. I mean, he suffered from, I think, guilt-related hives, and famously wrote a letter home from the base hospital saying, you know, I'm in the hospital, Mom and Dad, don't worry about me. It must have been something I ate, and just sort of left it at that. But he taught me to love everything and to eat everything, but still having 150 pounds of pork in my car, driving it home from the farmer on a day that happened to be the Jewish Sabbath.
Had to weigh a little heavy on
it
you.
It weighed a little bit like an albatross, right? Yeah, it was a little bit. I was dodging the lightning bolts, right? Yeah, right. Totally.
Yeah, that's it. Well, not only does food evoke a lot of memories, but it does also bring about many feelings of guilt in many ways. And I want to get into more of that when we come back after a short break. So stay with us.
This one is called Carried Away by The Hollows. We'll be right back.
The independence of his body is separated. Yeah, I can feel it pulling apart. There's an angel behind.
The following program has been brought to you by Tabard Inn. Tabard Inn, Washington, D.C.'s quintessential small hotel, is located on a quiet, tree-lined street just 5 blocks from the White House. Vibrant yet unassuming, the Tabard is comprised of 40 sleeping rooms, each unique in character and design. Feast on eclectic American cuisine in their acclaimed restaurant, or enjoy a cocktail and listen to live jazz in one of their cozy Victorian seating areas. Mingle with travelers from around the world who find the Tabard the only place to stay when taking their travels to Washington. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
Hi, we're back. I'm talking with Alyssa Altman, and Alyssa is a food writer, memoirist, just a writer. This food writer, you don't have to always be writing about food, although you do primarily always have something about food in your writing.
Well, we eat.
Yeah.
We all eat.
Her blog, Poor Man's Feast, is a must read if you are looking for a new blog to follow. And her newest book is called Trafe, My Life as an Unorthodox Outlaw. I always got to get that straight. But aside from food, and we're talking about how food evokes so much of our memories, food memories, oftentimes one of the first questions someone will ask a person trying to get them to get creative is, what's the first thing you remember eating? What's your first food memory? I think mine changes every time I think about it, but I don't. Do you have a first food memory?
My first food memory... That's a really good question. You know, my grandmother, my mother's mother, who is called Gaga in the book, and that's what I called her, didn't live with us, but she was in our house all the time. And I thank God for that, because I think if she wasn't there, I probably would have withered away. She was the greatest natural cook I've ever known, and she was an amazing Hungarian goulash maker, and she just she was born here. Both her parents came from Budapest, and I have very, you know, profound memories tied to tied to sitting at our breakfast counter and eating that side by side with her. My father was a wonderful cook. My father was a great cook. He was a breakfast guy, as a lot of guys are. You know, breakfast. But he would sort of go out and hunt and gather, kind of thing. You know, and always come back. You know, most Jewish guys come back on Sundays with bagels and lox, and he did that. He did that a lot. But his thing was bacon and eggs. You know, and there was always sort of a fatty porcine mist of, you know, bacon grease floating in the air. And you know, you could sort of feel it on the wallpaper.
Oh, yeah.
a little bit. The dog was always drooling, and you know, so there was, you know, there was that. You know, there was a lot of food in my life. Not all of it good. My mother had a habit of always incinerating the lamb chops whenever she made it.
That was a scene that I wanted to bring up about, because you mentioned something before about food, and it, depending on who prepares it, and food is love. Well, not necessarily always. Food is memories. Food is guilt. And you did write a beautiful scene. Not maybe not beautiful, but wrenching scene about your mother burning the lamb chops
every single time she made it. Every little, literally. And I am. I have been historically pyrophobic, so I've not been a great griller in my life as a food person, and that's changing now. Over the years, it's changed, but every time my mother made lamb chops, she would buy these, and I don't know why she bought kosher, because we were not kosher, but the rib chops that were very, very fatty. I mean, anybody who eats lamb knows that it's particularly fatty. She would sort of rub them down with vegetable oil of some...
Make them smoke even more.
Indeterminate variety. Put them in broiler foil. You remember broiler foil?
Yeah.
Stick it in the broiler in the bottom drawer of our chamber's oven and broil it. Put it on broil and walk away from it. And eventually, and these were before the days of smoke alarms and fire alarms, the dog would start to bark, and flames would lick out of the broiler and up the front of the stove, which was white. And my grandmother invariably had, you know, this sort of schmaltz caked, floured terry cloth towel that she would beat at the flat, and I would run screaming into the other room, you know, with the dog, because I was terrified of fire. But on this particular occasion that you're talking about in the book, my parents had a huge blowout, one of many, but they had a huge blowout, and my father stormed off for a couple of days, and we didn't know where he was, and my mother, I'm not sure she was so worried about where he was, but he did come back two or three days later, and as she had promised me he would. And she decided to make a quote-unquote celebratory meal of lamb chops. And she completely incinerated them. And she called for us, dinner served, you know. And we came in and they were, you know, you had to sort of scrape off the, you know, the char. And I think of places now, you know, that do a lot of open fire cooking, like Camino out in San Francisco. Mm. I can't get near grilled lamb chops now because of this. But what happens to food when you char it? You know, I'm sure that it's a chemical reaction, and Harold McGee would tell you in chapter and verse what it was. But it has a very strong, pronounced, bitter flavor. Mm-hmm. And so my connection to that particular occasion is that the taste of food cooked in anger and fury and rage in my mouth, and actually having that bitter flavor.
All right. And you even yourself brought up I'm blanking on the author, but like Water for Chocolate.
Laura Esquivel.
Yeah. Laura. And mm-hmm. it is that rang so true with me, that book, when I read that, is that you can't cook well when you're angry. You can't cook that well when you're sad, unless you're trying to make someone else not feel so sad. But the emotions, food evokes a lot of emotion, and then emotions affect food as well. It is true. It's very true.
It is true, and I don't think that we talk about that enough. In the world of food writing and not food writing, but writing in which food plays plays a part, and it doesn't always have to be categorized as food writing.
Right.
We don't talk about food that is cooked in anger, food that is cooked in sadness. It's not always comforting. It is memory. It does, you know, become a memory for some of us. But it's not always comforting, and it's not always lovely, and it's not, and that's part of the sort of human condition at the table. It just is what it is.
I am not a recipe follower. I read recipes voraciously, but then I cook my own thing. And the family inevitably said, "Well, how come it didn't turn out like it did last time?" It's because I'm feeling different. I am, you know,
right.
I am a different person today than I was that
yesterday.
Day, you know,
right.
and it just came out a little different, you know, aside from, you know, different ingredients and amounts, but yeah, food is very organic, you know, it's got to change.
It is very organic. And, you know, I said recently that, you know, when you write about food and you're writing about taste and flavor and, the olfactory, it's writing from senses.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, writing about sex is not that different, you know, and, you just have to pay attention. Yeah. You just have to really pay attention to what you're experiencing.
As a writer. That's an interesting point. Yeah. So we talk a lot about food and memories and food memories, but food also often represents guilt.
Yes, it does.
And guilt in a lot of ways. And, of course, we all know there are a lot of food body issues and food-related issues with women in particular.
Yes.
Any thoughts on that?
Well, you know, as I said earlier, I grew up in a household where my parents had oppositional relationships, not only to each other, but also to the table and to food. And my father, you know, was what we would call a fresser. You know, my father... Mm. Loved food in all of its guises, high food, low food, fancy food, Brennan in cars out here in Brooklyn. I don't know if you know, listeners will remember it. And my mother didn't and doesn't. And my mother is a former model. She's a former television singer. And she grew up in the late 1930s and 40s, always feeling that she was very heavy. And I've seen pictures of her taken at that time, and she might be a little bit heavy, but nothing, you know, I never would have said that had I looked at those pictures of her. And her goal in life was to be on this newfangled thing called television in the late 1940s. And she had been a radio singer where nobody could see her, you know. And so when she became a television singer, she dropped an enormous amount of weight.
Mm.
And so her relationship, food for my mother is, when she eats it, is fuel, devoid of emotional, psychological connection, good or bad. It just is what it is. Flavor doesn't really enter in for her. It's not something that she's particularly cognizant of. But I grew up believing that food was, on the one hand, for my dad, something extraordinary and cultural and historical. And you could talk about war vis-a-vis food, mm-hmm. you know. But where my mother was concerned, I learned to not really hide what I eat, because that's not something that I ever did, but to be very cognizant of my size and my inclination to always be thinking about, you know, food. And then when I decided to go into the food world professionally, and I had worked at Dean & DeLuca many, many, many years ago in its original, in the original store, I remember her saying to me, you know, why would you want to be seen in a place like, you know, like Dean & DeLuca? And of course, anybody who remembers that that place, the original store, it was like a wonderland. I mean, I learned everything that I was like a sponge. But with my mother, you know, eating represents it's not even a guilty pleasure. It's just there's a lot of guilt. And she still is. She's tall. She's thin. She's willowy. I don't think she's ever tip the scales higher than 115 pounds. She and I, people look at the two of us and like, are you related? Because you don't look related.
And yet I have to tell you that because I've seen a lot of pictures of her on your blog, and you, she is, you do look so much alike. Now, maybe it's in her older age, but I think you look very much alike.
It's so funny.
Very pretty. Very, have the,
thank you.
Well, maybe her short haircut, you know, does it.
Possibly.
You know,
possibly.
Yeah, but it's wonderful. Yeah, food and guilt. Well, there's guilt in a lot of other ways with food that women in particular, you know, feasting or fasting. I mean, you know, it's brought down by many religions, and then it plays into their body image. And
absolutely. I was actually just talking about to Diana Henry, the British food writer. I was just talking about I have this crazy, and it is a little bit of an obsession, which is ironic, this obsession with moderation. And where moderation, issues of moderation fall in our food community, because we do either feast or we fast. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you go on to anybody's blog, mine included, in mid-January, and it's all about, you know, the detox and the,
post-holiday blues.
Post-holiday and blah, 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 blah. And, you know, I mean, the holidays are the holidays. That's just what happens, you know, and that's a good thing. I don't think we should eat that way all the time. But the whole feasting and fasting thing has, I think, taken a hold of our culinary mindset, and certainly body image mindset in this culture. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure, you know, I'm not sure what to do about that except to pay more attention to it.
Well, and I think through your writing, just giving voice to so many of these feelings that people maybe are not aware of, mm-hmm. and that you really do bring them out in a lot of different ways, you know, through the guilt, through the memories, through whatever it may be. You know, it all works.
Yeah.
It's all good.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, and of course, guilt in many ways, trafe, as I said, being this trope for all the ways that you go against, you're going outlaw, you're being an outlaw, unorthodox. And it always gets back to food somehow.
It always comes back to food. I mean, food, you know, that's food is the tie that binds the generations. And it's where the rules were most ardently and immediately broken and easily broken. You know, the old expression, you are what you eat. And you know, my father, when he went off to the Navy, he ate completely differently than he did when he was living at home on Ocean Parkway and Avenue T with my grandparents in this Orthodox household. And everything changed for him, not always for the better, but everything changed for him.
Mm. Well, I, for one, am happy you wrote this book because it was a pleasure for me to read it. And as I say, I think we talked before the show, it transcends any particular religion, any particular growing up family. It's anyone can recognize what's going on and will relate to it in their own background, I would imagine. I mean,
well, thank you. I mean, yeah. I have friends from all backgrounds, you know, Turkish friends who I've known for years who have struggled with issues of, you know, assimilation and family expectation and ultimately and rule breaking. And so, you know, they get it. It's like that old, you know, Levi's rye bread ad. You don't have to be Jewish to love Levi's rye. So it's the same, yeah. It's the same idea.
Right. If you don't follow tradition, something must be wrong with me. What's wrong with
right.
me?
Right. Right.
Yeah. Well, thank you for joining me. Thank you for talking about it. Thank you for writing the blog Poor Man's Feast. And keep on writing.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed it.
And thank you for listening to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.